Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Lionel Shriver, author of The Motion of the Body Through Space, which was published in May by Harper. As you know, Lionel's written many novels, including a practice one. Perhaps the best known is We Need to Talk About Kevin, which won the Orange Prize for Fiction, but there are a dozen more now at least. And I recommend, especially given these times, The Mandibles, which is somewhat prophetic. And we last spoke with Lionel in 2012 about her novel, The New Republic. She writes for Harper's, The London Times, The Daily Telegraph, The Financial Times, and has a column in The Spectator. An older couple, Serenata Terpsichore, and her husband, Remington Alabaster, are a bit, in my opinion, like Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell in one of those wacky movies like His Girl Friday, in terms of their banter and repartee. Yeah, they're called screwball comedies. Maybe not as speedy as those, but every bit is biting and humorous, with a big thread of love that runs through every conversation. Well, almost every. Even when Remington announces he's going to run a marathon, Serenata almost does a spit take. But from that first sentence, Remington literally and figuratively runs as fast as he can from the potential anchor that Serenata might be to his efforts at rejuvenation since he's old. Well, 65, which upset me a bit since I'm 68 and Serenata is 60. They both gain a year during the course of their journey. So the novel provides a template within which we can deride or praise the subculture of triathlons, $10,000 titanium bikes, cute little French schoolboy bicycle hats, at least that's the kind my brother wears, spandex out the ass, so to speak, and a plethora of other gizmos and gadgets that men and women don in an effort to encase in a girdle the slow decline into old age and the feelings that arrive from it. So trailing like duck wings along in this swim are numerous characters that fill the story with more humor and derision and help to frame the feelings and emotions that Serenata, a recluse of sorts, feels and expresses through the entirety of the novel. Political correctness, cancel culture, cultural appropriation, new norms permeate the book and its examination of values, truly core or not. So hi, Lionel, and thanks for stopping by.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And I should say that you're stopping by for the second time because we did kind of a dress rehearsal for this interview, but what happened?
Well, we didn't think at the time it was a dress rehearsal, did we?
No.
So we should clarify to anyone who attempted to listen to or watch our original, as you call it, practice session, that it was recorded on Skype and the audio on my end was atrocious. It was impossible to understand, and so we are now repeating our interview, and it's my suspicion that it's going to be completely different from the first one.
Well,
but we will cover some of the same ground.
Not in the sense that most of what I say will be impossible to understand. That's generally the case on my show. But I will try to be a little less loquacious and spend up 45 minutes of the hour we talked. So I'll do the Terry Gross question, which is, tell us a little bit about your book and its characters.
Well, MBS, as it's known in our household, is about a couple on the cusp of old age, but they're not there yet. And as Serenata, my protagonist, observes, you know, now that her abruptly unemployed husband is 64, he could live 30 more years. And that's pretty sobering. You know, what do you do with that time? And so that's one of the things that my characters are asking themselves, and they're also asking themselves in what kind of shape are they likely to live that next 30 years. Remington, the husband, his answer is suddenly that he's going to first run a marathon, and then after he gets through that, he gets involved in the triathlon movement. And Serenata, the wife, has been privately involved with fitness her whole life, but she considers it her business. She has an aversion to group activities of any kind. And by the way, I share her aversion by sheer coincidence. I've always said that if I ever ran a marathon, it would be by myself. And you know how marriages work. They have territories. You know, you carve up the world. Who owns what? And fitness belongs to Serenata, not her husband. So he is encroaching on what belongs to her, which he makes fun of because it's corset. You know, he says, well, what? You know, you own fitness. You know, did you invent the push-up that you're so proud of doing? And of course, the idea of owning fitness is patently absurd, and she acknowledges that. But that doesn't change the fact that that's the way she feels, which is kind of interesting. And so Serenata is tolerant of her husband's new absorptions. Because, of course, she doesn't have a leg to stand on. I mean, she can't say, well, that's a waste of time, because she's been spending her own time that way to a large degree herself. So she has to keep her mouth shut, which is awkward. But at the same time, she suffers from a rising sense of contempt for the fact that here her very smart, previously quite politically knowledgeable and active and intellectual husband only talks about, you know, what shorts he's going to wear on a bike. You know, he's becoming boring. And the other thing he becomes is obscenely narcissistic. And this is one of the problems with becoming obsessed with fitness. It does make you boring. There's nothing more tedious than listening to someone talk about their running regime. But it can also make you very self-involved, and so that he ends up neglecting all the other people in his life and gets into especially the triathlon movement in a way that makes it seem like a noble effort, as if it's some kind of great spiritual achievement. And it's not. It's really a form of entertainment. I mean, as long as you treat other people in your life well, it's not hurting anybody. But it doesn't actually accomplish anything. So, I mean, this is a book that, it's first and foremost looking at a marriage and a marriage in crisis, increasingly in crisis. But it's also looking at the whole phenomenon of our increasing obsession with fitness and how competitive we are about it and how much we put on it, because secretly we think that if we get enough exercise, we're never going to get old, much less are we ever going to die. And I think that those assumptions require some serious examination.
That reminds me, because since I did have the opportunity to chat with you before, your husband's around 70 or so, right?
He's exactly 70.
And he doesn't do any exercise at all, right?
No, he doesn't. I mean, not any. And he still looks great. It irritates me a little bit.
And
although I get the benefit of living with an attractive man, so it's worth it. But it is astonishing. And also, I have more health problems than he does. My skeleton is falling apart because it has been pounded into the ground. And he's fine.
Yeah, because
he's pretty easily live to 90 and he'll still be fine.
But you,
there's something in that. He's a drummer. He carries his own kit here and there. He walks occasionally, but there's no program. He doesn't have a routine, and he's still in very good health. And it's kind of mysterious to me, but in a way, I really admire it.
But your regimen during most of your adult life has been much like Serenata's, right?
Oh, yes, certainly private, you know, and not very interesting. I mean, certainly I don't want to bother our audience with, you know, which little floor exercises I do while watching the news. It's tedious. It is boring. But it's interesting to me how important it is to me to continue to do that. And I'm not convinced it's to do entirely with the results. After all, it's not stopping me from getting older, and it's actually completely destroyed my knees. But there's a solace in it. I do it partly because I've always done it, right? It's circular.
Yeah.
And take it away from me, tell me that I can't do that anymore. I would feel a sense of grievous loss and even a sense of personality dislocation, like, who am I now? I feel a sense of loss of control. These are all things I give to my protagonist, because there's a point in the book, not to give too much away.
Well,
she suddenly can't exercise anymore, and it plunges her into a real identity crisis. She gets incredibly depressed, and it's a little crazy, because of course the truth is that it's tedious, it's not fun, and you have more time in the day. It should be something of a release, but it isn't. So, and I in writing the book, and even in choosing to write the book, I came to the realization that I was not the only one who felt this way and had overly identified with the process, which is fundamentally mechanical, or it is to me, but that if you take it away, it's like, who am I? Or I'm out of control, or I'm going to fall apart, I'm going to melt. It's interesting. So why does this kind of an activity root itself so deeply in our psyches?
I know.
So I thought it would be interesting to other people to examine it.
I've had a personal trainer for 22 years now, and I don't have him because I feel like, oh yes, I'm entitled to have a personal. I only have him for one reason, which is if I don't go to work out, I feel like I'm disappointing him. And so I have no discipline at all. If I didn't have the trainer, there's no way I would go to the gym. But because I have him, even though I'm paying him, I feel like if I don't show up, he'll be disappointed in me.
Isn't that almost a kind of projection? Like you've created and animated your own conscience?
Yeah, that's my whole life. My daughter, this like, it is like calling the kettle black in a way. My daughter called me yesterday and she goes, Dad, I just took a test and I realized you're a narcissist. And then she goes, except there's five questions and the last one was, is he empathetic? And she goes, yeah, I guess you're a little empathetic. So, but otherwise you're a narcissist. Which of course, since the way, what I'm saying now.
Well, I think a lot of us could make that confession if we're honest with ourselves.
Well, you know, as far as Serenata's concerned, the way she feels about whether it's true or not, I invented this. Don't you have friends like when you go to a movie, it's like they own the movie, it's their movie, or books too. And
yeah,
that's really irritating as well. It's like they've taken possession of somebody else's creative work. And I've had several friends.
I understand it though. I mean, I think that ownership is a sensation. It's not just a legal entitlement. In fact, I did a whole collection of novellas and short stories previous to this publication called Property. And that's one of its main themes, is ownership is a state of mind. And so in Serenata's case, she's repeatedly had the experience of discovering a passion or doing something that seems unique to herself. And then suddenly it becomes a fad nationwide, if not worldwide. And this private thing that she owns is taken from her. And I give a number of examples, and a couple of them are like books and movies that used to be obscure, so especially like books, and then suddenly they're turned into movies, and everybody knows about it, and it's no longer special to believe in a book that everybody knows about and everybody's seen the movie. And there's a funny sense of loss there. Or she when she was in her mid-teens, she got a tiny tattoo of a bumblebee on the inside of her wrist. It's a very small tattoo, but nobody was getting tattoos at that time aside from, you know, longshoremen and bikers and people in prison. And then, you know, nowadays, everyone's covered in them. So it's no longer a strange thing to have done. And so it diminishes the meaning of that tattoo for her.
Right.
I find that kind of interesting. It happens a lot. It's happened to me in relation to the bicycle. I've biked as primary transportation since I was 8 years old, since I got my first bicycle. I only learned to drive when I was about 35, and it didn't take, you know. I drove for a year because I had to for a book, and then I abandoned it. But otherwise, I bike everywhere in all weather, and at any time of day or night. So that's been a kind of identity thing for me for a long time.
Tell the story.
Well, how special is it now to bike everywhere? I mean, I go anywhere and I'm crowded by all these nouveau cyclists, and I resent them. I actually hate them.
Well, tell this now. I hate them too, since our last conversation. But tell the story of in the book of Serenata, which is exactly like you riding and all these other bikers, and how she feels about that. She just, because you express it so well in the book, and it's an important bike ride. You know, she needs to.
Oh, there's one particular bike ride. She takes down the West Side Bikeway, which I've taken thousands of times in New York. And she gets into a competition with someone on a city bike. City bikes in New York are the public bicycles. I hate them.
I hate the
phenomenon of metropolitan bike systems. And city bikes have inundated New York. And I hate them because they're in my way. Let's not put too fine a point on it. And my interest in cycling has nothing to do with the environment, by the way. I think you can tell. So Serenata gets into a competition with this guy, and these are clunky bikes, and it's hard to make them go fast, but this guy is so obsessed with the fact that she overtook him that he's going to show her, and he just goes nuts. And he's hugely younger than she is. Right, she's by this point she's 61, and he's in his 20s, and she allows herself to get involved in this, which is juvenile, and she has horribly arthritic knees, and so determined to show him back, you know, that You know, she may be older, and she may be female, but, you know, that doesn't mean she can't bike fast.
It's
she really pours it on, and then her knee pops.
Right.
And she is in utter agony. And that's so much for the city biker who goes off into the distance. She has to pull over. She can't bike anymore at all. She has to use the bike as a glorified, you know, walking cane. And it, you know, it's just a little miniature moment of what people are like in relation to fitness right now. And that includes, I'm afraid, my protagonist.
Well, you're going to London next week. You spend a great deal of your time in London. And when I'm there, rather than take the lift, I look at the stairs and it has a warning. There's 596 stairs. Do not attempt to climb them unless it's an emergency. And I always run as fast as I can up the stairs because I think, well, as long as I can do this, I'm not old. But one time there was a triathlete type, and I'm thinking exactly like Sarah, I'm not going to let him get to the top before me. And it almost killed me. And it was so infuriating that he beat me, and he beat me by just a little bit. But yeah, so I understand exactly. And I understand the idea of adopting something, and then people think, well, you're a later adopter when you actually were the first one.
Right.
Drives me crazy. But back to the books, because we're trying to sell a book. Oh, yeah, and this is the other thing that I'm always interested in is epigraphs. And sometimes people just skip them, but I figure the author must have spent a long time thinking about which epigraphs to use, and especially when you do too. So you don't have to have them at hand, but the first one is Melanie Reed and the kind of glory of suffering. And the second is From Things Fall Apart and Chi. So why did you choose those two epigraphs? How did you happen to?
The Melanie Reed epigraph, it's something like the...
I can read them.
The glorification of suffering is humanity's most recycled con trick. And I really responded to that quote because there's nothing ennobling about suffering. And if you've ever really suffered, you know that. It's only horrible. And it doesn't have an improving effect on character. It's just bad, and less suffering in the world is good. It's not as if I don't believe that you need to sometimes push yourself to do something you don't want to in order to achieve something. But the suffering itself is not ennobling. And I think that the endurance sport industry believes that pain is a kind of experience of self-glorification, that they revere pain. And they also don't, you know, there's a sense in which there's no respect for it, that you're just supposed to push past it. And that's how you injure yourself, badly. You could really have injured yourself on those stairs.
Yeah.
And I, by the way, I've had that experience running. I did a terrible damage to my hamstring that put me off the road for about 3 months because I got involved with one of those competitions, was running along the Thames, and some guy passed me and then slowed down. And female runners have this experience all the time because male runners cannot bear to have women in front of them. It doesn't matter how fast you're going. You can be going along at a good clip, but having a woman in front of them is, to men, demeaning. It's unmanning. And therefore, he had to get in front of me. So he got in front of me and then slowed down. And I'm not going to slow down to protect his ego. So I pass him back. And then we're off, right? So he started gaining on me. I started picking up the pace. He started picking up the pace. you should never be tempted into this. This is a terrible, terrible thing to do. Well, I beat him, but at a terrible cost. I screwed myself up for 3 months.
Well, so you embrace suffering too, even though you're...
Well, no, I'm hopelessly competitive, apparently.
Yeah, it's like I say, not as I do.
But no, that I shouldn't have done that.
Right. Well,
and the suffering that I experienced was not a noble one. Not while I was running faster than my pace, not when I was suffering the consequences. It's so, and I have enormous regard for pain. You know, it's very hard to remember pain.
It's, otherwise we wouldn't exist.
Yeah, I think there's a line in the book somewhere that I paraphrase, that if you could remember pain, you'd never leave the house. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, you just wouldn't take the risk of doing anything. And when you do experience pain, I mean, especially high level pain, it's like, what is this? This is just awful. This is unendurable. And it's also strangely isolating. It's socially isolating. You know, it puts you in a different world from other people. They don't understand what you're going through. Abstractly, they remember pain. Oh, you're in pain. But they're not feeling it.
Right.
So it's like pain over there. It's like, oh, that's too bad.
Yeah, I know. It's like the burn.
They don't. They're not in your world. You're all by yourself. There's nothing lonelier than pain.
No, there's certain things like, well, it's like sneezing or ejaculation or yawning that you're outside. You're not in control of any of those things. It's almost like you're not. It's an interesting thing because you are not yourself anymore. There's just all there is the feeling.
Mm.
But
yeah.
Well,
one of the things that I'm interested in, and which runs through a subsection of my fiction, is the relationship between self and body. I think it's incredibly complicated and universal. You know, there's nothing more universal. That we all have selves and bodies. And I find the fact that is a relationship in itself interesting. It's not a unified experience. You both are and are not your body. It's confusing. And it's hard to decide how much to identify with it and how much to care when something goes funny with it.
Well, that's going back to Serenata instead of you. The other part of her personality and her being is that since she's kind of a misanthrope and doesn't really immediately react to people in a positive way, I was entranced by the way that she and Remington meet and her immediate attraction to him. And I didn't quite understand it, but now having some time, I do. So why don't you explain why it seems like she just went out of her normal way of life and all of a sudden found this guy, almost kind of love at first sight kind of thing.
Well, to some extent, of course, that response is inexplicable. And I hope you've been through it. It's never mathematical. You can make your explanations, but they're beside the point. When you respond to someone in that way, and it's exhilarating. And it's best probably not to question it or examine it to death. I think we could say she's drawn to his sense of self-possession. He has a clear purpose in life. He's interested in transportation of all things. But apparently, you noticed me on biking, and I got exercise. Actually, as Remington himself points out, everyone has violent opinions about transportation, you know, about some intersection that desperately needs a traffic light because you can't see at the stop sign. Lots of people hate cyclists, for example, more opinions about transportation. So that's attractive, you know. He has a passion, and also he immediately sees something in her, and she, I gave her this little backstory just for fun, because obviously I wanted to be a writer when I grew up, when I was a kid. So she initially decides she wants to be a writer, partly because she likes the idea of all that solitude. Her idea of fun is being completely left alone. But then she comes to realize that she doesn't care that much about other people. And she also wants to keep her secrets. So she doesn't want to be confessional. She doesn't want to pour out her soul on the page. She wants her privacy. So this is not really the right profession for her. And all along, Remington is just listening to her. He falls in love with her voice.
Oh, yeah.
He loves her voice. And urges her very early on in their relationship, in fact, in their first date, to consider becoming a voiceover artist, which is indeed what she ends up becoming. And that also provides a lot of solitude. She can do that with very few people. But that was her real talent. And after all, that's attractive, that when other people see in us our best abilities, perhaps that we haven't even spotted ourselves.
It's interesting how you say Serenade didn't want to pour herself out on the page or her passions or part of herself. Yet in this book, as we've talked last time and this time, normally you get the silly question, is this book at all autobiographical? Well, when we talk, it seems as if you almost take on the skin of Serenade, you know?
Well, I gave her some of my own attitudes and opinions, and then I do that in any book, and I do the same thing with other characters to a lesser degree.
That's
or
true.
I will construct characters which are deliberately in opposition to my own feelings and opinions, and this book is no exception. Serenata's nemesis in MBS is a personal trainer like the one you've got, whose name is Bambi Buffer. That's obviously a work handle, but it's creepy. It's deliberately creepy.
Yeah, she's...
And Bambi is a knockout. Bambi is tall. Her muscles are so perfectly defined that she looks like an anatomy book illustration. There's a tiny little waist, just well-developed calves, and, you know, she's virtually perfect. And her husband becomes transfixed by her. This is not fun, right? This is, and of course, Bambi's half Serenata's age. So, you know, she beats her on all fronts. And Bambi is, you know, she's an almost religious advocate of endurance sport. So this is Serenata's opposite. And Bambi has an awful lot of advantage over Serenata, just in terms of looks. But she also is pretty good at holding her own in arguments, because as far as Bambi is concerned, Serenata's skepticism about endurance sport is just because she wouldn't be able to do it herself.
Yeah, Serenata's the catastrophizer.
Yes.
And I love when she talks about which president had the toe injury that became an infection, or was it
Calvin Coolidge. Actually, that's a true fact. Calvin Coolidge's son died because of an infected blister on his toe from playing tennis, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, and Serenata uses that as an argument, which isn't the best, but it's certainly, in some ways.
Well, it's the story that she brings out when one of the members of Remington's Tri Club, as it's called, gets an infected blister on his toe. So she remembers this story, and then Bambi makes fun of her for being a catastrophizer, as if, you know, an infected blister means the member of the Tri Club has a death sentence. But Bambi finds that hilarious. And you know, Serenata does tend to look at the negative. The endurance sports industry tends toward positivism and sunniness. And Serenata is dark.
Dark and
chronically hostile.
Although
I would like to add that though she comes across as aloof, I mean, I made her that way. I created her that way. Aloof, standoffish, a little suspicious of others, arm's length. She's the only person in the book who ever does anything nice for other people.
I know.
Yeah. There's not a single line in the book that points this out to the reader. I want the reader to notice slowly. But she's the one who takes care of her father-in-law, who's, you know, coming up on 90 and quite frail, and lives in the same town as the couple do. And so she goes over all the time and brings him food and brings in his firewood, and most importantly, of course, spends time with him and has an affectionate relationship with him, while his son, her husband, is completely oblivious and has given up on visiting his father almost altogether. And there are any number of other points where Serenata is the one person who, though she seems like a misanthrope, is caring about other people and thinks about their needs. And while I wouldn't want to give the end of the book away, that culminates in her making a considerable sacrifice on behalf of someone else. So, you know, characters more complex than just, oh, she's a misanthrope, oh, she's negative and she's hostile to other people. Once Serenata lets you into her sphere of affection, she's very loyal.
And that's, it's interesting that we talked about Bambi, but if you talk about, and I want to, some of the other characters, a lot of this book, well, actually the crux of this book and the reason why the marathon, the first part, the marathon, not the triathlon, occurs is because of a woman named Lucinda. And she is, she's the boss of Remington, and because of her actions, his life has completely changed. Talk a little bit about her. And how that happened.
Okay, well, Remington was second in command at the Albany, New York Department of Transportation. So he did pursue his passion for transportation. And once he reached the age of 60, he would have assumed that when his then boss retired, he would take over the department. I mean, he had the seniority. But instead, the city hired someone else who was less than half his age, black. She's a second generation Nigerian and female. So ticks all the diversity boxes. And that was not a coincidence. But this woman is completely unqualified. She does not have a degree in transportation or city planning or anything like that. She has a degree from Columbia in gender studies. And she's very politically woke, and she brings in all kinds of new policies in the department, like, you know, you can't use single-use plastic at the office, and so everybody drinks their Cokes outside. And she takes down certain monuments by people who had the wrong opinions 200 years ago, that kind of thing. But she finally does something to do with a matter that Remington really cares about. And that's LED streetlights. And Remington is not opposed to LED streetlights per se, but he does a lot of research on it for the department. He does a whole report. And he recommends that it's important to choose housing for LED streetlights that are a shield the lights from invading residents' houses, because it can be ugly and intrusive. But most importantly, he wants them to have a relatively low Kelvin rating. When you get up to a Kelvin rating of a maximum 5, the quality of the light is very blue and ghoulish. It's hard, and it makes everyone look dead. It's depressing, and he's right, by the way, surprisingly. whereas once you get down to closer to the level of 3, it warms up, and there's not that big a difference between the more efficient LEDs and the old orange kind that you and I would have grown up with. But Lucinda high-handedly makes the decision to change all the streetlights in Albany to LEDs with a Kelvin rating of 5. Without bothering to consult his report. And in fact, you even suspect she may have consulted it just enough to do exactly the opposite of what he recommended. And of course, with no shielding light. And so Remington has a single moment of losing his temper, and he slams his hand on her desk. And this is enough to drag him before an employment tribunal, because he's accused of being a misogynist and being a racist, and this is classified as a form of assault because he hit the desk. And so this is not quite midway through the book, and you have a transcript of the entire tribunal. And this is the kind of thing that gets me into terrible trouble and angers far left readers, if they even read me, because if you recognize yourself in a couple of the people who are running the tribunal, then you wouldn't find the portrait very attractive. Frankly, it's hilarious. It's hilarious. It's meant to be. And it is definitely a send up of identity politics and of course the entire construct of having having someone who ticks all the diversity boxes hired over someone who might have been more qualified, like Remington, who had earned that position, is also questioning affirmative action.
And the third person in the tribunal who's the fairest, but he's the fairest because he's kind of tired and he wants to go home, but he also realizes that Lucinda is kind of a pain in the butt.
Yeah. And he's black. I mean, the person who's really reasonable and has a sense of humor and think this is overblown is the black guy who's been put on the panel to make them look good, right? So,
It is hilarious.
And he doesn't care for Lucinda. You know, she's a bit much for him.
Well, and like you say, you do press a lot of triggers, and trigger warnings, which is another term, as I said last time, that Serenata would hate. But Remington says during the hearing, he uses the word niggling. And then he goes, can I even use that word here? And it's just, yeah, that would anger a lot of people that he actually uses that word, whereas the word has nothing to do with the derivation of the word that I can't say.
Yeah, well, I mean, I am in some ways most irked by identity politics incursions on language, because that hits me where it hurts.
Yeah.
So I don't like being told I can't use a whole range of words because they're suddenly, you know, they're being removed from the dictionary.
Or if you express your opinion here in this interview and someone hears it, just like with She Shouldn't Have Done It, which just like J.K. Rowling did in her Twitter things about the silliness of calling women with a Y. And, you know, it's you're born a woman, you're born a man, that's what you are. It makes perfect sense to me, but she's lost hundreds of thousands, if not millions of fans. And even the actors who were in Harry Potter, or some of them.
Well, that's been an interesting story. I have to say I'm glad that she has stuck by her guns and not backed down. I think what makes it most interesting is, first off, she's backed a lot of identity politics. She's one of their own. She's not some right-wing Tory. You know, she's definitely a Labour supporter, and yet I guess she has her red lines, and this is one of them. She does believe in the reality of biological sex, and she will not be shamed out of that position. And she also doesn't want biological men into women's spaces, like rape counseling, domestic violence refuges, and she wouldn't like biological men to compete against biological women in sports. You know, it's actually a very moderate position. It's perfectly reasonable. Whereas, you know, she still supports trans rights, and as I would. You know.
Oh, the thing is,
but she's uncancelable.
Right. Correct.
Right. She's uncancelable. She's worth so much to Bloomsbury, if I recall correctly, that they will stick by her. I would say the depressing side of that story is that I'm not entirely sure that if she were some first novelist on whom they lost money last time, that she'd get anywhere near the support or any support, right? So it's enjoyable as theater to watch them try to take her down and fail because they can't. And of course, that makes it even worse because they get frustrated and go even more nuts. And I gather they're now burning her books on video.
Yes.
Which to me just makes them look bad. Book burning, really. But this is the theater is just watching what happens when you go for someone who has just way more power than you do. So, but there are lots of other writers who don't have that kind of power. In fact, almost all other writers don't have that kind of power. And so I don't think it necessarily is a story about, the brave publishing industry sticking up for freedom of speech.
No.
The self-interested publishing industry knowing on which side its bread is buttered.
And really all she's asking for is someone to listen to her. But she listens to other people and she listens to their opinions, and she doesn't denigrate them necessarily because they have those opinions. She just expresses her own, which is why America is so polarized, and Great Britain, because no one listens to each other. And whether it's abortion or the death penalty or gun control, they don't listen to the other position. No one does anymore. And as you said, your position that you take in the book, or the various positions you've taken in your writing or your life, are going to immediately alienate a certain segment of what would otherwise be your readership, because it's not about what you say, it's about the quality of your writing. If they just recognize they're not adopting your positions, they're simply enjoying and understanding and learning from your writing. They're two completely different things, and they've all melded together now, which is why we're in such trouble.
Yeah, I think it's a shame that artists in general are now expected to pick a side. And I think that's anti-art.
You can't be nominated for an Academy Award anymore unless you meet the certain level of diversity in the terms of the director, the actors. You have to, it's a formulaic thing, which makes no sense at all, but nonetheless.
That's affirmative action. And I'm not a big believer in it.
Yeah, and Democrats are worse than shooting themselves in the foot by these positions they're taking now. But be that as it may, let's go back to the book again. I think we talked about this last time, is they have two children, both completely different. But one of them is my favorite character in the entire book. So if you remember his name, talk a little bit about him.
Deacon.
You said Duncan last time.
Well, I thought one of the nice things about doing this again is we could correct our mistakes.
Sorry.
All right.
I can take it out.
Deacon is probably a drug dealer. He never admits it, but he doesn't try very hard to deny it either. And he's incredibly good looking. And maybe I got this idea from my husband, but because that's how I know there are these people. Very attractive. And the most exercise he ever gets is lugging a six pack and a bag of Doritos from the mini mart to the car. Right? That's it. So how does he do it? And Deacon's presence around the Tri Club drives them crazy, because he is magnetic. He's also very cool. And they're not exactly. You know what I mean? I mean, cool is an interesting quality. It's one of those qualities you can't take apart. You can't explain it aside from the fact that you've either got it or you don't.
And he's not trying. Well, you can't try to be cool.
You can't be. Well, that's the most uncool thing you can do, is try to be cool.
Poser.
That just ruins everything. Like, forget it. And then they're strivers, and they have all their various private reasons for being involved in this triathlon project, but they're not cool. And he's cool, and he's stunning, and he has complete contempt for their project. You know, why would you want to do that? When, you know, you can pour yourself another whiskey. why would you go run 26.2 miles when you could watch TV? You know, it just doesn't make any sense to him. So, and yeah, he's a fun character. You don't get him until near the end of the book. But,
yes.
And he and Serenata have an interesting relationship, because it evolves, and there she identifies with him and she thinks she shouldn't. I mean, obviously she doesn't approve of the fact that he's probably dealing drugs, but they're both loners, and they're both not joiners, so they don't run with the crowd, and therefore have a lot in common.
And he, whereas Serenata's kind of wound up about it, he's just totally laid back about it. He's not really, he doesn't get him upset. And that's why he can penetrate through Bambi, so to speak.
He's not impressed with Bambi.
No.
And Bambi's used to manipulating men, having them at her feet, because she's a goddess, you know. She's an icon. She's the perfect woman. And he doesn't care.
And then his sister, the daughter, and this is where I might pronounce things wrong, is Valeria. Is it Valeria?
That's right.
Valeria. So Valeria is a different kind. Well, if you consider Deacon dysfunctional, which he is kind of, but Valeria's she is in a different way. She's dysfunctional, well, two different ways, actually.
Valeria is very needy. She's dramatically different from her mother. All right, Serenata realizes much too late in the day that she made a big mistake with her daughter, because when Serenata was growing up, as I mentioned, she loved to be left alone. And she really appreciated the fact that her parents gave her lots of time to herself to pursue her own little obsessions. And that gave her, as far as she was concerned, the ideal childhood, which is exactly the kind of childhood she tried to provide her daughter, which was the last thing Valeria wanted. What Valeria wanted was attention, and she didn't get it. Valeria, as an adult, has a chip on her shoulder. In fact, there was a period of about 4 years in her 20s when she completely disappeared on her parents. They had no idea where she was, whether she was well, whether she was alive. And by the way, that's a very cruel thing to do to your parents. I don't recommend it. Then she finally shows up again, and it turns out in the meantime, she's converted to born-again Christianity. She's become one of those evangelical people who knock on your door and you hide from, or I do. And furthermore, she's decided to forgive her parents, and they have no idea what they're being forgiven for. So, and this is never explained. She believes that she's been subject to child abuse, but they have no idea what she's talking about. You know, they never beat her. They can't think of anything they did wrong, aside from this one supposition that Serenata puts together, is that she should have been more hovering, you know. But beside that, it's they have no idea what she's on about. And also, Valeria is one of these evangelicals who keeps having children, because that's one of the things you're encouraged to do in those communities. Though by the end of the book, when she's pregnant again, you can tell
she's just, yeah,
she's a little crushed. Now even Valeria isn't ready to be pregnant again.
It must be fun writing a passive-aggressive character.
It is, yeah. And it's a very commonplace mythology. So it's not hard to come up with the lines.
Well, I know, because I know the lines. It's like when I was using an architect and I wanted to do a certain thing, he goes, it's always like that. Do you think that's the way you want to go? I mean, do you think that's right? Oh, would you, not even right. Do you think that's something that you would enjoy doing? It drives me crazy. I just want to hit them. I would much rather them be aggressive.
Yeah, aggression is easier to take.
Yeah, that's why it must be so much fun to write, because the phraseology, I'm not saying it comes easily, but it's easy to, you know, it's easy to figure it out. You know what they're going to say.
Mm-hmm.
So the other character that I really like, but is so vulnerable, is Tommy, who again, going back to the suffering, she's willing to suffer as much as anybody could possibly suffer in order to be part of this tribe.
Well, Tommy's an important character. She's the 19-year-old who lives next door. Her mother's a shut-in. She hasn't gone to college. She's important partly because Tommy is also involved in fitness and is trying to fit in with her peers and trying to keep up with how many, you know, burpees you're supposed to be doing. And has trouble. You know, what makes her important, I guess, is that she's likable. You know, she's just a decent young person who has got caught up in what people do now, and she ends up striking up a friendship with Serenata, who hires her to clean their house and give Tommy some pocket money. And it's, you know, I've done this before. I did this in The Mandibles. I think sometimes relationships between people who skip a generation between them, you know, because Tommy's actually younger than Serenata's child would likely be. There's something about that relationship that, you know, you can both inform each other. So it's not one way. It's not just, you know, the senior party is lecturing about, you know, this is what I've learned from life. But Serenata doesn't have access to young people anymore. Her kids aren't proper young people anymore. And Tommy can inform her about what's going on. You know, Serenata won't do social media. Tommy can tell her what it's like and what people consider offensive now. And so it's, you know, it's a two-way relationship, and it's very affectionate.
Yeah, and they have that same banter. It's like one of my daughter's friends who, I took him to get ice cream, and I had my COVID hat on, which I wear now. And I took it off for a moment, and she goes, "Oh, I thought you were a lot balder than that." And then she looked at my shoes and she goes, "What kind of shoes are those anyway?" Because they were kind of like slippers because I didn't want to put shoes on. And I love when kids do that, because another person might say, "Don't talk to your elders like that. How dare you?" or something. You know, I don't expect that kind of language from you. But to me, I love it. And I think you.
Yeah, refreshing.
Yeah. And Tommy and Serenata do that about her cleaning not being sufficient and things like that.
They treat each other as equals. And that's one of the things that makes the relationship. So Serenata the girl may be 19 years old, but it's a level playing field, and that's what makes the relationship work, so that they genuinely confide in one another.
So Serenata and you and I probably have the same thing where can you size somebody up in like 5 to 10 seconds and know whether you can insult them, and they will interpret it as an expression of affection. Like my father called me a jackass for 30 years, and it took me like 20 years of therapy to realize he was actually saying, "I love you." Mm. And sometimes if you mess up, that's the end of everything. But if you can peg them pretty well, do you have that capacity to do that? Because, you know, you're going to be biting at times. You are. But I find it wonderful. So, yeah, we kind of size each other up fairly quickly. But do you do that? Are you able to do that?
No, I think we all do that. We're always sizing each other up.
Yeah, true, but
it's instinctive. Whom can you trust? And what you're really talking about is a kind of trust.
Yeah, but it's like Deacon being cool. Some people are naturals at it. Some people can do it well, and some people can't, and some people never do it. A lot of people never do it, I don't think. But be that as it may. We talked a little about this is is Hank, who's one of the tribe of triathletes. And when he gets drunk, he does this certain thing. And you actually had a friend who does the same thing. Talk about that. You know, the book. Have you read?
This is just a little moment, really.
Yeah, but I like that.
Hank is poorly educated. He's been in and out of prison and is very self-conscious around Serenata. Serenata not being publicly involved in fitness, he is at a loss as to what to talk about. He also has a drinking problem. So he tried to reach out to Serenata and asked her if she'd ever read Rory Moore's Birds of America. And Serenata responded warmly, you know, that was trying to enter her world because she sometimes reads audiobooks and Hank knows that. So, you know, she said, yeah, I have read it. I thought it was really good. And then, you know, the next time they see each other and he gets really drunk and he asks her whether she's ever read Rory Moore's Birds of America. And she says, yes, I have, but she's a little more curt. And by the time this happens, like the fifth or sixth time, and he asks her yet again in slurred voice whether she's read Rory Moore's Birds of America, she just says, yes!
Well, that's what I'm talking about. It's the ability to do that.
And then he looks wounded. It's like, what did I do? You know, because when you're drinking heavily, you don't remember that you've already done this, right? So.
But also, you once again, you drew this in part from an actual person.
Someone did that to me. And I thought that was an interesting sequence.
Are you at that age yet where I am definitely at that age where you tell stories three times to somebody without remembering that you've already told them the story?
I think I've always been like that. I've always had an appalling memory in relation to a whole range of things. And the one advantage to that is that I have less capacity to deteriorate than most people. I've never been able to remember anyone's name. There's never going to be a point in my life that I suddenly can't remember anyone's name. I've always been like this.
I've forgotten the name where you can't remember faces at all. And I always say, oh, I don't have my glasses on, or I couldn't recognize you from the distance. Or now with COVID, it's great because with your glasses on, I have no idea who you are. You also can't tell whether you're insulting someone unless they have laughing eyes. If they don't have laughing eyes, you don't know whether you've insulted them or not, which is interesting because laughing eyes, I didn't realize they existed, but they really do. But yeah, I don't remember anybody. And I think it's because I don't really care.
You're a narcissist.
Yeah, and I don't really care to interact with them. You know, it's not interesting to me for the most part. Yeah, I'm a narcissist. But yeah, there you go. Someone might take that as an insult that you just called me a narcissist. But I don't. I mean, it's funny because it's funny. If it's funny, it's not an insult. That's the way I look at it. And I think that's like Jerry Seinfeld is the same way. If you're not funny, he's not going to talk to you. There's no reason for him to do so. But in any event, yes. And that's the other thing. Serenata really is very funny. And that's another reason why Remington is so attractive to her. And he's funny too.
Well, they're dry.
Extremely.
It's a certain kind of funny.
Well, this time we spoke for an hour and 22 minutes. And I think we spoke longer because this time I allowed you to talk.
Yeah, see what happens? I never shut up.
No, you didn't, kind of. And I tried to, like, sneak in, but it was hard.
Well, this was a different conversation. We hit some of the same points.
Yeah.
But didn't always say the same things.
No, but we got a lot more.
More interesting for us.
And we got a lot more of your book out because I didn't, you know, take up a good portion of the time this time. I kind of wish
you were very disciplined.
Yeah, I was, because I'm a narcissist. Okay, well, if this doesn't work, I don't want to do it a third time, do you? Hopefully this will work. Or we can just...
Yeah, that could get into, you know, worry more birds of American territory.
Yes.
See, as we repeat this over and over again, my answers could get more and more curt.
No, we either never talk again or we go out and get a drink or something.
Like right. That. Anyway, I enjoy talking to you. This is fun.
Likewise.
I'm glad we went to the effort of doing this again.